We're going to start, when we look at the text, we're going to start in Revelation 17. But before we do that, I brought some stuff that I was going to read to you, just to give you a taste of what's out there if you want to start looking at some of these ancient histories and ancient historians. I've got an excerpt here from Tacitus, who was a Roman historian, didn't think much of the Christians at all, and I've got an excerpt here from Josephus. Okay, both of these are dealing with the time of the destruction of Jerusalem. Okay, and I want you to keep some of the things in mind that you've read in the scriptures when you hear these things. I'll read, I'll start with Tacitus. Prodigies had occurred. A prodigy is a remarkable event. Prodigies had occurred, which this nation, the Jewish nation, prone to superstition, but hating all religious rites, did not deem it lawful to expiate by offering and sacrifice. There had been seen hosts joining battle in the skies, the fiery gleam of arms, the temple illuminated by a sudden radiance from the clouds, the doors of the inner shrine were suddenly thrown open, and a voice of more than mortal tone was heard to cry out that the gods were departing. At the same instant, there was a mighty stir as of departure. Some few put a fearful meaning on these events, but in most there was a firm persuasion that in the ancient records of their priests was contained a prediction of how at this very time the East was to grow powerful, and rulers coming from Judea were to acquire universal empire. These mysterious prophecies had pointed to Vespasian and Titus, but the common people, with the usual blindness of ambition, had interpreted these mighty destinies of themselves, and could not be brought even by disasters to believe the truth. I have heard that the total number of the besieged, of every age and both sexes, amounted to 600,000. All who were able bore arms, and a number more than proportionate to the population had the courage to do so. Men and women showed equal resolution, and life seemed more terrible than death, if they were to be forced to leave their country. Such was this city and nation, and Titus Caesar, seeing that the position forbade an assault or any of the more rapid operations of war, determined to proceed by earthworks and covered approaches. The legions had their respective duties assigned to them, and there was a cessation from fighting till all the inventions used in ancient warfare or devised by modern ingenuity for the reduction of cities were constructed. Now, I want to point out what Tacitus just says. He says that the Jews were superstitious and didn't believe in appeasing the gods. And then all these things had appeared, and they didn't expiate them by sacrifice. And so they got... That's a pagan interpretation of this. But what does Tacitus say happened? There had been seen hosts, armies, joining battle in the skies, you know, heavenly armies, the fiery gleam of arms, the temple illuminated by a sudden radiance from the clouds, the doors of the inner shrine were suddenly thrown open, and a voice of more than mortal tone was heard to cry out that the gods were departing. Okay, there was a mighty stir of departure. And this was obviously, Tacitus said, a bad omen, but the Jews, in the grip of self-deception, interpreted it as a good omen. This was Tacitus, the Roman historian, writing about the destruction of Jerusalem and what occurred in Jerusalem shortly before the destruction. Josephus was a Jewish historian, and he had been part of the Jewish revolt. Josephus was a commander of Jewish forces north in Galilee. When the Romans came in, Josephus saw the handwriting on the wall and surrendered early on. And the people who were besieged in Jerusalem took a long time to surrender. So Josephus was a Jew under the protection of the Romans, writing a history of this event. And he'd previously been a commander in the revolt. Okay? This is Josephus from Book 6, Chapter 5. Besides these, a few days after that feast, on the 1 and 20th day of the month Artemisius, a certain prodigious and incredible phenomenon appeared. I suppose the account of it would seem to be a fable were it not related by those that saw it, and were not the events that followed it of so considerable nature to deserve such signals. For, before sunsetting, chariots and troops of soldiers in their army were seen running about among the clouds and surrounding of cities. Josephus reports the same thing that Tacitus does. Moreover, at that feast, which we call Pentecost, as the priests were going by night into the inner court of the temple, as their custom was, to perform their sacred ministrations, they said that in the first place they felt a quaking and heard a great noise, and after that they heard a sound as of great multitude saying, "Let us remove hence." But what is still more terrible, there was one Jesus, the son of Ananus, a plebeian, and a husbandman who 4 years before the war began, and at a time when the city was in very great peace and prosperity, came to that feast whereon it is our custom for everyone to make tabernacles to God in the temple, began on sudden to cry aloud, a voice from the east, a voice from the west, a voice from the four winds, a voice against Jerusalem and the holy house, a voice against the bridegrooms and the brides, and a voice against this whole people. This was his cry as he went about day and by night in all the lanes of the city. However, certain of the most eminent among the populace had great indignation at this dire cry of his, and took up the man and gave him a great number of severe stripes, yet did not he either say anything for himself or anything peculiar to those who chastised him, but still he went on with the same words which he cried before. Hereupon our ruler, supposing, as the case proved to be, that this was a sort of divine fury in the man, brought him to the Roman procurator, where he was whipped till his bones were laid bare, yet did he not make any supplication for himself, nor shed any tears, but turning his voice to the most lamentable tone possible, at every stroke of the whip, his answer was, "Woe, woe to Jerusalem." And while Albinus, for he was then our procurator, asked him who he was and whence he came, and why he uttered such words, he made no manner of reply to what he said, but still did not leave off his melancholy ditty, till Albinus took him to be a madman and dismissed him. Now during all the time that passed before the war began, this man did not go near any of the citizens, not was seen by them while he said so, but he every day uttered these lamentable words, as if were his premeditated vow, "Woe, woe to Jerusalem." Nor did he give ill words to any of those that gave him food, but this was his reply to all men, and indeed no other than a melancholy presage of what was to come. This cry of his was the loudest at the festivals, and he continued this ditty for 7 years and 5 months, without growing hoarse or being tired therewith, until the very time that he saw his presage in earnest fulfilled in our siege, when it ceased, for, as he was going round upon the wall, he cried out with his utmost force, "Woe, woe to the city again, and to the people, and to the holy house." And just as he added at the last, "Woe, woe to myself also," there came a stone out of one of the engines and smote him and killed him instantly. And as he was uttering the very same presages, he gave up the ghost. So this was a fellow who was apparently used by the Lord to testify to the coming destruction. And it was not just a political thing, because Josephus and Tacitus both, neither of them Christians, testified to signs in the heavens right prior to the destruction of Jerusalem. Okay, we're going to look at Revelation 17. And we are going to consider some of the internal and external political evidence for an early date for Revelation. Now, you remember that last week we talked about a thematic reason for dating the book of Revelation early, and I want to give you some political dates, and we'll talk about how the book of Revelation is to be dated on that basis. We'll read verses 9 and 10, which we've already looked at, but we're going to look at them in greater detail. "Here is the mind which has wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sits. There are also seven kings. Five have fallen, one is, and the other has not yet come. And when he comes, he must continue a short time." Now, this is a clue that enables you to date the book, and you have to take account of this passage, whatever date you set for the book. Five have fallen, one is, and one is to come, and when he comes, he'll remain a short while. Okay, five were, one is, and the one has not yet fallen. Another way of saying this is that the sixth is currently reigning. The sixth is currently reigning. Now, the emperors up to this point, well, first, I should tell you that among preterists, you recall that preterists are people that believe that the prophecies were fulfilled in the first century. There are two major schools among preterists as to the identity of the beast. One school is the one that I'm representing here, and that is that the beast is Nero. There's another school of preterists who believe the beast is Domitian. Okay, Domitian is a later Roman emperor. He was reigning in the 90s AD. Okay, so some preterists believe that Domitian was the beast, and others, like myself, believe that Nero was the beast. And how they come to these different conclusions, I think, will become apparent as we go through this. If we go through the Roman emperors, number one was Julius. Julius reigned from 49 to 44 BC. Julius reigned from 49 to 44 BC. Secondly, Augustus, who reigned a long time from 31 BC to 14 AD. Augustus, 31 BC to 14 AD. Number three, Tiberius, AD 14 to AD 37. AD 14 to AD 37. Number four, emperor number four, was Caligula. His you can also see him referred to as Gaius, G-A-I-U-S. But I think most people know him as Caligula. AD 37 to AD 41. Claudius was number five, AD 41 to AD 54. AD 41 to AD 54. Nero was the sixth emperor, and he reigned from AD 54 to AD 68. Okay, so you have Julius, Augustus, Tiberius, Caligula, Claudius, and then number six is Nero. Now, the people who say, the preterists who say that Domitian is the 666 have to do certain things with this list in order to get that, because they want to have Revelation 17 be referring to Domitian. Now, this is what you must do. Right after Nero was a succession of emperors, Galba, Otho, and Vitellius. Right after Nero was the year of the three emperors, or the year of the four emperors, depending on how you count it. So Nero dies, then there was Galba, Otho, Vitellius, and then Vespasian. Vespasian reigned for a while. So if you just count the three short ones, it's the year of the three emperors. If you count the three short ones plus the one who lasted for a while, Vespasian, then you have four in quick succession. After Nero died, there were three emperors in quick succession, all within the space of a year. The preterists who say that Domitian is the beast do not count Julius. Okay, they don't count Julius. They start the count with Augustus. So the five would be Augustus, Tiberius, Caligula, Claudius, Nero. Okay, then the sixth would be Galba. It's being written during the reign of Galba. And the one who is to come, they come up to Augustus, Tiberius, Caligula, Claudius, Nero, and then they don't count the year of the three emperors. They don't count those three emperors. They skip over them and say the sixth is Vespasian. Okay, when it says five were, one is. The five were Augustus through Nero. The one is Vespasian. The one who is to come and reign for a little while is Vespasian's son, Titus. Okay, so that gives you... And then after Titus is Domitian. So Vespasian, Titus, and Domitian. So Domitian is the eighth in this series. Okay, so that's how they get that. They don't count the three emperors, and they don't count Julius. They, the things that are pointed to in support of a Domitianic beast are the fact that, according to some, Domitian persecuted the church, like Nero did. He was a persecutor of the church. Although the fact that Nero persecuted the church is indisputable, and there's some dispute about whether Domitian persecuted the church really in any extensive way at all. Some people don't think he did. Some people think that there was a persecution under him. It's up in the air. We're not sure. But they would say he was a beast because he persecuted the church. And secondly, there is a coin issued by Domitian, who, again, you recall, reigned in the 90s. There is a coin, and the way Domitian's name and title is abbreviated on the coin, if you add up the numerical values of the letters on the coin, it adds up to 666. Okay, but it is an abbreviation, not a name. Okay, it's what's issued on the coin. So they would say you discount Julius, you discount the three emperors, you take the abbreviated coin as evidence, and you take the fact that Domitian persecuted the church. Okay, if we go the way I'm going, which is to start with Julius, and I'm going to give some reasons for doing that. It's not just I don't think it's a question of taking you pays your nickel and you takes your choice. I think you can investigate it and determine whether Julius should be counted and whether the three emperors should be counted. Okay, we can, I think, establish that. Before we go on to do that, I want to mention that Galba, who reigned after Nero, reigned for 7 months. So most of that year was occupied by Galba, who immediately followed Nero. He reigned from June of 68 to January of 69. Galba reigned from June of 68 to January of 69. Okay, was Julius the first emperor? Was Julius the first emperor? Now, the reason this is even a question is because technically he wasn't. Okay, everyone agrees that technically Julius wasn't an emperor. The question is, would he have been listed as an emperor in ancient histories, in ancient accounts? Was he considered as an emperor, even though technically he did not hold that position? He was the first of a line of reigning Caesars, and I think we can see this in the treatment of a number of people. I've referred to Suetonius already, S-U-E-T-O-N-I-U-S. Suetonius wrote a book called the 12 Caesars, or something like that, the 12 Caesars or the Lives of the Caesars. Suetonius was a Roman knight, and if you want a good glimpse of Roman court gossip and what things were like at the Roman court from a pagan perspective, read Suetonius. According to Suetonius, Julius claimed the title Imperator. Julius claimed the title Imperator. And Suetonius himself, when he does the Lives of the Caesars, he includes Julius. So if you get a copy of the 12 Caesars by Suetonius, the first chapter is Julius. So Suetonius lists Julius among the other emperors. Another Roman historian named Dio Cassius, Dio, D-I-O, new name, capital C, Cassius, who lived from 150 to 235, 150 to 235 A.D., Dio Cassius begins his history of the emperors with Julius. He reckons Julius is the first of them. Other books which list Julius as the first emperor are 4th Ezra, the Epistle of Barnabas. The Epistle of Barnabas is a early work, and various Sibylline oracles. Writings around this time listed Julius as a emperor. A Christian writer, his name is Theophilus of Antioch, he lived from 115 to 168. So this is shortly after this time. 115 to 168, Theophilus of Antioch said, now this is a quote for you, "The annual magistrates ruled the Romans, as we say, for 453 years. In the period of the Roman Republic, it was a republic and it was ruled by a Senate, and the Senate was governed by someone who held a term of office for 1 year. So the Romans ruled themselves with people taking 1 year terms of office. They ruled themselves that way for 453 years. This was stopped under Julius. Okay, Julius was the point when that ceased. So he says, they ruled the Romans, as we say, for 453 years. Afterwards, those who are called emperors began in this order. Caius Julius, who reigned. So he says, 453 years. Then after this, the emperors began. The first one he identifies as Julius. Josephus, whom I've already read in another connection, counts Julius as the first emperor. Now we can summarize by saying that modern historians tend to begin counting with Augustus. Modern historians tend to count Augustus as the first real emperor. Ancient historians tend to count Julius as the first emperor. Okay? Modern historians count Augustus as the first emperor. Ancient historians count Julius as the first emperor. And because we are interpreting the book of Revelation, which is an ancient book, we should use the ancient reckoning in that regard. Okay? Now, just briefly, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this. Should we count Galba, Otho, and Vitellius, the three emperors? Well, Suetonius in the Lives of the Caesars does. You know, there's a chapter for Galba, there's a chapter for Otho, there's a chapter for Vitellius. They are reckoned by Suetonius. Tacitus, whom I've already read, reckons the three as emperors. Josephus reckons the three as emperors. And Theophilus of Antioch, whom I've already quoted, reckons those three as emperors. So I don't think we have any warrant for dropping Julius, dropping the three emperors, and in order to get a Domitianic beast when it's questionable as to whether Domitian even persecuted the church, and the only connection with 666 is the abbreviation of his name on a coin. I think you're having to do too much cutting and pasting in order to get that date. But if you assume a pre-70 AD date for Revelation, and you start with Julius, it goes 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 5 have fallen. 1 is, the book is being written during the reign of Nero, who indisputably savaged the church and persecuted it. No one disputes that. And then after Nero dies, the 7th, Galba, reigns for just a little while, it says. Galba reigned for 7 months. Okay? And then, he says, and then comes an 8th. And you recall that I said the 5, the 6th, the 7th, and then an 8th. The future sort of, I won't say blurs, but it's not John's primary concern what happens after the 7th emperor. He's concerned about practical application right now. Okay, but he says the 8th carries on the tradition. An 8th is just like the 7 in lots of ways. Okay, take all that, and let's go back to Revelation 17, 9 and 10. Here's the mind which has wisdom. The 7 heads are 7 mountains on which the woman sits. Now, the woman, you recall, is the harlot, Jerusalem, and is not the beast. The woman is sitting on the beast, depending on the beast for her existence. There are also 7 kings. 5 have fallen, 1 is, and the other has not yet come. Now, if you have a futurist interpretation, you've got a real problem with 5 have fallen, 1 is, and the 7th has not yet come, because you've got to say that at the time this was written, 5 had already gone under the bridge, 1 was, and then you have to jump 2,000 years for the one that is to come. All right, if you're applying this prophecy to the future, you have to apply the 7th to the future and 6 of them to the past, and then you've got this big gap in there. But if you take it in a preterist sense, you've got 5, 6, and 7, and it just fits without having to pound it or force fit it in. And when he comes, he must continue a short time. And the beast that was and is not is himself also the 8th, and is of the 7, and is going to perdition. Now remember that John uses the term beast to refer to one of the particular heads or to the entire animal. So the whole thing can be the beast, or one of the heads can be the beast. He can be dealing with one particular ruler or emperor as the beast, or he can be dealing with the whole thing. And when he's dealing with the 8th, an 8th, I think he's talking about the beast generically, the whole beast as represented by various heads after that. Now, turn to Revelation 11. Now, this is a passage we've not looked at so far, and I want to go through it slowly and carefully, and I hope you will be able to see how this sort of thing is to be trampled, this sort of thing is to be handled. Then I was given a reed like a measuring rod, and the angel stood, saying, "Rise and measure the temple of God, the altar, and those who worship there. But leave out the court which is outside the temple, and do not measure it, for it has been given to the Gentiles, and they will tread the holy city underfoot for 42 months. Okay? Now, what does it mean for John to measure the inner sanctuary and not to measure the outer court? He says, do not measure it, for it has been given to the Gentiles, and they will tread it underfoot. Now, the measurement appears, and I don't want to be dogmatic about it, but I can see it fairly clearly. Measuring seems to be a means of indicating God's protection. All right? Don't measure the outer court, because that's been given to be trampled by the Gentiles. But measure the inner court, because that's protected. God will protect it. If you had measured the outer court, it would have been protected from the Gentiles, but leave that out of your measurement. Now, there are a number of interesting before we go further, keep your hand there and look at Luke 21. Luke 21, 5 and 7, 5 through 7. Okay, then, as some spoke of the temple, how it was adorned with beautiful stones and donations, he said, "As for these things which you see, the days will come in which not one stone shall be left upon another that shall not be thrown down." And they asked him, saying, "Teacher, but when will these things be, and what sign will there be when these things are about to take place?" And he said, "Take heed that you not be deceived, for many will come in my name, saying, 'I am he,' and 'The time is drawn near.' Therefore, do not go after them. But when you hear of wars and commotions, do not be terrified, for these things must come to pass first, but the end will not come immediately." Then he said to them, "Nation will rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom, and there will be great earthquakes in various places, and famines and pestilences, and there will be fearful sights and great signs from heaven. But before all these things, they will lay their hands upon you and persecute you, delivering you up to the synagogues and prisons, and you will be brought before kings and rulers for my name's sake. And it will turn out for you as an occasion for testimony. Therefore, settle it in your hearts not to meditate beforehand on what you will answer, for I will give you a mouth and wisdom which all your adversaries will not be able to contradict or resist. You will be betrayed even by parents and brothers, relatives and friends, and they will send some of you to your death. And you will be hated by all for my name's sake, but not a hair of your head shall be lost. In your patience, possess your souls. But when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then know that its desolation is near. Then let those in Judea flee to the mountains, let those who are in the midst of her depart, and let not those who are in the country enter her. For these are the days of vengeance, that all things which are written may be fulfilled. But woe to those who are pregnant and those who are nursing babies in those days, for there will be great distress in the land and wrath upon this people, and they will fall by the edge of the sword and be led away captive into all nations, and Jerusalem will be trampled by Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled." Okay, and there's more. But I want you to see that Jesus is very clearly talking about physical Jerusalem and the physical temple. Right? The disciples are sightseeing in the big city, and they're pointing out the beautiful ornaments, how it was adorned with beautiful stones and donations. Josephus, incidentally, tells us how beautiful the temple was. This is the temple of Herod. Josephus tells us that if you went on the opposite mountain, where the temple was, which was on Mount Zion, okay, Mount Zion is where the temple was, and that's where we get all our references to Zion and so forth in hymns. Right? Zion is associated with the temple. If you went across from Zion, which was on the Mount of Olives, and looked at the temple, Josephus said you couldn't even look directly at it when the sun was shining on it, because the temple was plated with gold. The whole temple was gold-plated. And when the sun shone on it, you couldn't look at it. And the disciples were really impressed. It was adorned with beautiful stones and donations and so forth. There was wealth there. Tacitus, when it's talking about Titus's desire to get into the city, says, "The army demanded the more perilous alternative, some prompted by courage, many by," this is the Roman army, "many by sheer ferocity and greed of gain. Titus himself had Rome with all its wealth and pleasures before his eyes. Jerusalem must fall at once, or it would delay his enjoyment of them." Excuse me, I thought that was talking about the wealth of Jerusalem. Titus is talking about wants to get home. Titus wants to go home to Rome with all Rome's wealth. But some of the Roman army, at any rate, was prompted by gain. And what happened was, in fact, in the destruction of Jerusalem, there are so many Jews crucified that it was like a forest of crosses, like woods full of crosses. Jews had started to flee the city, and Roman soldiers who were greedy thought that they were smuggling gold and precious stones out by having swallowed them. And so when they caught Jews coming out of the city, they would slit them open to look for the gold or look for the precious stuff. Anyway, Jerusalem had this wealthy, wealthy temple. The disciples were very much impressed. And Jesus said that this physical temple, this physical Jerusalem, is going to be destroyed. Not one stone will be left on another. Are you familiar with the Wailing Wall in Jerusalem? The Wailing Wall is not a portion of this temple, but is rather a retaining wall that was built up in order to enable the temple to be built. The temple, not one stone of the temple was left on another. Jesus' words came true, but the Wailing Wall is a portion of that construction project. It's a retaining wall that helped keep the temple up. Well, the disciples were very impressed, and Jesus said, not one stone is going to be left on another. This is all going to be destroyed. Now, Jesus, later on, speaks apocalyptically with signs in the sun, moon, and stars, and so forth. But here, he's talking about literal Jerusalem will literally be destroyed. This literal temple will literally be dismantled. Okay, and then Jesus says in Luke 21:24, and Jerusalem will be trampled by Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. Back in Revelation 11, the same thing that Jesus is referring to, the trampling of physical Jerusalem under the feet of foreign armies. The Gentiles will come in and will trample on, take care of Jerusalem. Now, what is the significance of this measuring rod? When you measure in the measurement of the temple, the internal temple is protected. The external temple is destroyed. Okay, the internal temple is protected. The external temple is destroyed. Turn to Revelation 20. I'm going to find it first. It's talking about Revelation 21. Verse 9. Then one of the seven angels, who had the seven bowls filled with the seven last plagues, came to me and talked with me, saying, come, I will show you the bride, the Lamb's wife. Okay, so what does the angel say he's going to show John? The wife of the Lamb. Now, who is the bride of Christ? The church. The wife of the Lamb is the church. So he takes him off to show him the Lamb's wife. And what does he show him? And he carried me away in the spirit to a great and high mountain and showed me the great city, the holy Jerusalem, descending out of heaven from God. Okay? Having the glory of God, and her light was like a most precious stone, like a jasper stone, clear as crystal. And she had a great and high wall and with 12 gates, and 12 angels at the gates, and names written on them, which are the names of the 12 tribes of the children of Israel. 3 gates on the east, 3 gates on the north, 3 gates on the south, and 3 gates on the west. Now the wall of the city had 12 foundations, and on them were the names of the 12 apostles of the Lamb. And he who talked with me had a gold reed to measure the city, its gates, and its wall. Okay? See the connection with the measurement? Now, the thing that's interesting is in the physical temple, what was the holiest part of the temple? The inner sanctuary, the Holy of Holies, right? The Holy of Holies was the place where the high priest would go in once a year. And he would go in on Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. He would go in once a year to make atonement for the sins of the people. And the high priest used to have a little bell or bells on his robe, so people outside could hear him moving. And he also went in with a rope tied around his ankle, because if he died in there or something, no one else could go in. Right? If he died in there, they'd have to haul him out with a rope, because this place was the holiest of the holy. The only one person, the chief priest, could go in there, and that once a year. Right? Well, the construction of the Holy of Holies was, the Holy of Holies was a perfect cube. Right? The Holy of Holies, that room, was a perfect cube. As is the New Jerusalem in Revelation. The New Jerusalem is 1,200 stadia by 1,200 stadia by 1,200 stadia. The New Jerusalem is a perfect cube. Now, what does John do in Revelation 11? He's given a measuring rod, and he's told to measure the inner part of the temple and leave the outer part unmeasured. Well, I believe what is being talked about here is that the temple, we as Christians, are the temple of the Holy Spirit. We are the temple of God. We are the New Jerusalem. We are the New Israel. We are the wife of the Lamb. The Christians were to be measured and protected. The outer court the outer temple, the external temple, was not to be measured because it was not to be protected. It was to be trampled on by the Gentiles. Okay? Now, turn, just so that this, first, before I leave this thing on the New Jerusalem in Revelation, if you took the measurements literally, 1,200 stadia is 1,500 miles. Okay, a city, a perfect cube of a city, with a gate every 500 miles on each. Actually, no, it'd probably be less than that if you placed it from the corners. But 1,500 miles. If the New Jerusalem landed, and you interpret this literally rather than symbolically, it would cover up the eastern portion of the United States from the Mississippi to the Atlantic Ocean and stick clear up into outer space. It would be 1,500 miles by 1,500 miles way up into outer space. I think you have a real problem taking the New Jerusalem as a literal manifestation, especially when it's identified as a symbolic thing. I will show you the wife of the Lamb. So the New Jerusalem is to be identified with the Christian church. We are the New Jerusalem, not some physical city that's coming. Now, the thing that's interesting about this is it's very easy to get this muddled. And if you get it muddled, you will when you get it unmuddled, you will realize that much of our terminology for heaven comes from imagery of the New Jerusalem. Pearly gates, okay, streets of gold are images that come to us from the New Jerusalem. Well, these are representations not of heaven, but of the Christian church. These are symbols not of heaven, not of the afterlife, but of the Christian church. Now, if you had a gate, let's say you've got a 1,500-mile stretch, and three gates in 1,500 miles, and each gate, it says, is made out of a single pearl. Okay? And we're talking about pretty big gates, right? And each gate is made out of a single pearl. Now, that means God has a giant planet somewhere with giant oysters, great big oysters. Or there is a symbol here. What's the symbol? Well, on each of the foundation stones are the 12 apostles. In Ephesians, it says that the foundation is the foundation of the apostles and prophets. Okay, there's a foundational ministry that the apostles had. Let's look at a couple other places where the New Jerusalem is talked about. Turn first to Hebrews. Hebrews chapter 12. Verse 18. For you have not come to the mountain that may be touched, and that burned with fire into blackness and darkness and tempest. That was the mountain in the wilderness where the law was given, Sinai. And to the sound of a trumpet and the voice of words, so that those who heard it begged that the words should not be spoken to them anymore. For they could not endure what was commanded, and if so much as a beast touches the mountain, it shall be stoned, or thrust through with an arrow. And so terrifying was the sight that Moses said, I am exceedingly afraid and trembling. But you have come to Mount Zion. Right? Now, Zion was where the temple was built. Okay? But you have come to Mount Zion and to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, to an innumerable company of angels, to the general assembly and church of the firstborn, who are registered in heaven, to God, the judge of all, to the spirits of just men made perfect, to Jesus, the mediator of the new covenant, and to the blood of sprinkling that speaks better things than that of Abel. Now, verse 22, what mountain have we come to? Mount Zion. Verse 18, have we come to a literal mountain? No. You have not come to a mountain that may be touched. Now, Mount Zion is equated with the heavenly Jerusalem. You've come to the assembly of the firstborn, the general assembly, to an innumerable company of angels. You've come to this living reality called the New Jerusalem, but don't think it's a mountain that can be touched. You have not come to that kind of physical place. You've come to a heavenly Jerusalem, and we are part of that heavenly Jerusalem. Let's look quickly at Galatians. There's another reference to it. Okay, Galatians 4, verse 21. Tell me, you who desire to be under the law, do you not hear the law? For it is written that Abraham had two sons, the one by a bondwoman, the other by a free woman. But he who was of the bondwoman was born according to the flesh, and he of the free woman through promise. Which things are symbolic? For these are the two covenants, the one from Mount Sinai, which gives birth to bondage, which is Hagar. For this Hagar is Mount Sinai in Arabia, and corresponds to Jerusalem, which now is, and is in bondage with her children. But the Jerusalem above is free, which is the mother of us all. For it is written, Rejoice, O barren, you who do not bear. Break forth and shout, you who do not travail. For the desolate has many more children than she who has a husband. Now what do we have here? Two covenants, the old covenant, the new covenant. Two women, Hagar and Sarah. Two mountains, Mount Sinai and Mount Zion. Two Jerusalems, the physical Jerusalem below, and the heavenly Jerusalem above, who is our mother, and we are her children. Whenever you pray with someone, and they become a Christian, and let's assume for the discussion that they really do, okay? What that means is that the heavenly Jerusalem above, our mother, has given birth to another child. Right? The barren woman is now has many, many children. The new Jerusalem is a spiritual reality. It is not a physical, touch it, pound it, go put it in the bank kind of reality. It is very clear in Corinthians when he's telling the Corinthians to avoid sexual immorality. He says, to do so because you are the temple of the Holy Spirit. You are, and then Peter talks about us being living stones, being built up into a heavenly structure. And the whole tone, from beginning to end, every time the New Testament speaks of the temple of God in Christian terms, it always applies the structure of the temple to the saints. The saints are the temple. It's in the Old Covenant, they had synagogues and they had a temple. They had a temple in Jerusalem, which was where sacrifices are made. That's the definition of a temple. A lot of people are confused on terminology. A temple is where there's an altar with sacrifices made to a god. That's a temple. A cathedral comes from the Latin cathedra, which means chair or throne. That's a Roman Catholic concept. A cathedral is a place where an archbishop or bishop rules. There's a throne there. So you can't build a great big church and say this is a cathedral, because it's not a cathedral if there's not a throne there. Okay, that's so then there's a cathedral, and then we have churches. Well, churches are meeting halls. They are synagogues. They are not temples. Okay, and you can see over time as people get farther and farther away from the Reformation principle, which is that the church exists wherever there is the teaching of the word, the administration of the sacraments or the ordinances, and discipline. Okay, where there's a body of people meeting in the name of Jesus Christ. When they get away from that, what happens is instead of having people gathering together to hear the teaching of the word, you have the churches become more and more like temples. Okay, what do we mean like temples? Well, they have altars. You know, a teaching hall, synagogues, don't have altars. Right? In the Jewish world, you had synagogues, which were meeting halls. There was the reading of the law, the exposition of the law, and so forth. And there was one temple in Jerusalem. But for Christians, there are many meeting halls, and one temple, which is the Christian church itself, the invisible church, is the temple. So the visible church, the visible structure, ought not to be built like a temple. All right, visible churches ought not to have sanctuaries. All right, we have no business building a sanctuary. Why? Because we've not come to a mountain that can be touched. Right? That's not how we're to function. We still live in the physical world. We still have to hear the word spoken and so forth, and we need something to keep the rain off. All right, there's nothing wrong with having a meeting hall, but there's something with treating your meeting hall as though it were a temple. And then to begin to decorate it and make a sanctuary or a holy place, dim lights, candles. What are you doing? The whole point is to have this inner place, this sanctum sanctorum, seem more like a holy place where God dwells. But see, the Reformation principle is that God dwells in us. It's the New Testament principle. God dwells in us. We are the living stones. We are the temple. We are the new Israel. We are the new Jerusalem, not these physical things that we build. And we do these things. We perceive this reality by faith. That's how we understand our place in the temple of God. We can only perceive it by faith. When faith dwindles, people who are religious will begin to gravitate to a more sensual religion. Roman Catholicism, for all its problems, has a very aesthetic worship. Right? They've got beautiful churches and smells and bells, and they know how to put on a real show that appeals to the senses. And if you have the form of godliness, but not the power, then eventually that's where you're going to be. Okay, because you cannot deny the real temple without finding yourself in an external temple some way. Coming back to Revelation, it was an external temple which was destroyed, not measured. It was the internal temple, the Holy of Holies, the people of God, who were measured and consequently protected from the onslaught of the destruction. Well, any questions? Clear as crystal.